Hello, my name is Larry Rubin, and I'm with the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Today is January 27, 2008, and I'm here with Admiral Robert Wertheim as part of the PONY project to evaluate U.S. and U.K. nuclear cooperation as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Mutual Defense Agreement. Admiral Wertheim, if you could begin by briefly describing your career to date.
I'll start with my graduation from the Naval Academy in 1945. I joined the Pacific Fleet on a destroyer just before the hostilities were ceased in the Pacific with the dropping of the top two atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which brought the hostilities to a close. I continued to serve on destroyers in the Pacific and got called into the nuclear program by being named as one of a group of naval officers to report to New Mexico to learn how to assemble nuclear weapons for the Navy. This was the Navy's first nuclear assembly team. That was my first exposure to nuclear weapons, other than as a beneficiary for bringing the World War II to an early close, which probably saved hundreds of thousands of lives, both American and Japanese, by terminating the war when it did. And in any event, after 2 years at the Sandia base in Albuquerque, I reported to other duties, eventually being sent to the U.S. Navy's postgraduate school program, where I ultimately received a degree in nuclear physics from MIT. Subsequent to that, after further service at sea on surface ships, I was called into to Washington to participate in the first nuclear weapons program, submarine ballistic missile program, is called Special Projects Office, which was originally formed to take the Army's nuclear missile, the Jupiter, to sea on surface ships, in order to bring Soviet targets within range at a time when there was a desperate race going on between the Soviet Union and the United States and the development of intercontinental range ballistic missiles. The concern was that the Soviets were ahead of us, that we had no comparable means of deterring the use of a ballistic missile to deliver a nuclear warhead on the U.S. cities, and that by putting a shorter range missile on board a ship, you could carry it within range of Soviet targets and thereby counter the Soviet threat with a kind of comparable threat. This program quickly evolved into a submarine program instead of surface ships, submarine program using new Navy-developed solid propellant ballistic missiles to be launched from underwater. That program was initiated in January of '57 with that same group of Special Projects Office. And I was given the responsibilities at that time for the development of the payload for this new missile called Polaris. That was really the beginning of the most interesting part of my career, I believe, the most significant part. And that was that association with the submarine launched ballistic missiles lasted through most of my remaining career. They were interspersed by a few other assignments, Navy laboratories and the such, but I became a specialist officer focusing on on weapon systems, missiles, and nuclear weapons. Ultimately, I retired from the Navy in 1980, at which time I was the director of that program, which had in the meantime transitioned from Polaris to Poseidon, and we were just deploying the first Trident missiles when I retired. The remainder of my career, I served in civilian life as a senior vice president of Lockheed Corporation for Science and Engineering until 1987, in which when I retired from that and came down to San Diego to retire, enjoy the good life and play golf, but that was frustrated by a request for service on government advisory groups and committees, study groups, which I still do. And of interest to this particular interviewer, I think, is the fact that one of those assignments was with the National Academy of Sciences Committee on International Security and Arms Control, you might call it back channel communications were established with the former Soviet Union, and then ultimately with the Russian Academy of Sciences, also with the Chinese Academy of Sciences and others. Through which I became much more involved with some of the policy issues and of interest to this group. I've also served and still do serve on the U.S. Strategic Command's Strategic Advisory Group, and that I've served for over 25 years on that in that capacity. I think that brings us pretty much up to date. I've served in a number of other roles, including advisors to the government's nuclear laboratories at Los Alamos and Livermore, and to the University of California, which has for most of the time since the war continued to be the contractor or to the government for the operation of those laboratories.
Wonderful. I'd like to take us back a little bit in history and go back to the Mutual Defense Agreement, actually, of 1958. And I want to get your thoughts. Well, first we'll start with the question of how you think it's impacted naval strategy, U.S. naval strategy. And want to get your impressions of this, as well as possibly any types of comments you've had either related to experiences with the British counterparts, but also your specific policy involvement at the time and so forth, because this is what you had said, this kind of jump-started this time period in your life is when you became heavily involved with these projects and later becoming the Polaris system.
I was not really particularly aware of the Mutual Defense Agreement until 1962, when I was serving as a staff member to the military assistant to the Secretary of Defense, which at the time was Robert McNamara, and in particular his Secretary of Defense deputy for science and engineering, Dr. Harold Brown, with whom I had worked earlier in the Polaris program. He sent for me when the administration changed, so I was serving as a military assistant in that office. At the time, the British were working with the U.S. on an air-launched ballistic missile system called Skyhope. This system was the British were counting on to in order to equip their V bombers force with a weapon that could stand off with enough range to to stay out of harm's way from the very substantial air defenses that the Soviets were deploying in order to maintain their independent deterrent. That for a variety of reasons, the U.S. decided to cancel that program, the Skyboat program, leaving the British more or less in the lurch. And so President Kennedy met with was planning to meet with the then Prime Minister Macmillan in 1962 on Nassau to agree on a substitute program to Skyhope. And I was called upon as one of the staff members to participate in writing up the one of the options to be offered to the British, which was the purchase of Polaris to equip British submarines with the, that system. Ultimately, that was the one, that was the option that was chosen by the British, and that became the basis for what was called the Polaris Sales Agreement between the U.S. and U.K. The executive officers to project officers to carry out those agreements with for the U.S. was the Special Projects Office, my own office, and the and for the British was a new Chief Polaris executive counterpart to the director of the Special Projects Office, and so that was the origin of my associations with the British, which lasted from that point, 1962, to the end of my career, we could talk about the various aspects of it, but basically that was the origin of my involvement with the British under the various agreements.
More on a, I guess, possibly partially on a personal level, as far as your interaction with some of the British, some of your British colleagues in that sense, so they became colleagues in that way. What was it like to interact with them on these scientific and technological levels, as well as with some of the policymakers?
It was a very constructive and rewarding experience to work with our counterparts. We had they established an office in London in the Ministry of Defense, and we had American civilian and military representatives assigned to that office to facilitate the carrying out the terms of the agreement. There was the same sort of a situation existed in Washington, and in our office we had a military a group from the Royal Navy and from the, and their civilian associates assigned to our office. We met regularly with them. We were quite open in exchanging the information. The program basically consisted of the sale to the United Kingdom of Polaris missiles and weapon systems, less the nuclear warhead, which was designed and developed independently by the British, but with assistance through other channels for the atomic information, nuclear weapon information that was through an entirely different channel than our office. Our office was responsible for the weapon system itself, both the ship installed equipments and the missiles themselves, and all of the associated training and the like, manuals, etc. But the association was a very positive one, and I think that both the Royal Navy and the United States Navy relations were strengthened. There always had been good ties between those two navies, ever since the War of 1812, I guess, which was a low point. But we were very, very close, and that association, as I said, was a positive one. I might remark great attention was paid to the details, and I think the success of the program is largely because of the leadership that was provided on the part of the U.S. leaders at the time. I was not a leader at the beginning of the program, but later assumed the responsibilities as a prior sales agreement executive agent, but project officer rather. Mm-hmm. We paid attention to such details, for example, as the wording of the manuals that were to be used by the British sailors.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't just take the American manuals and give it to them because, strangely enough, the U.S. and the U.K. speak a similar language, but not identical.
Right.
And some words mean different things to a British sailor than they do to Americans. So we actually contracted for having our manuals, maintenance manuals, and other training operational manuals anglicized.
Mm-hmm.
The wording was examined and changed where necessary in order to make certain that the message was identical.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just an item of the example, but our relations were very positive, and as far as I know, still are.
It's an interesting anecdote that you mentioned about the manuals, and I was wondering other ways in which, well, not only the United States might have learned or definitely benefited from that cooperation, but may perhaps the British in the sense of over a period of time, if there are ways that you could think about other things as far as the United States. Obviously, in this sense, we've got an idea of maybe you can draw out a broader lesson of cultural sensitivity, so to speak, making sure that when you're cooperating with other forces that this might be, you know, something to be aware of. And maybe it's not a question of cultural sensitivity, but this is purely communication. Words meaning different things and going beyond just spelling extra things with a U. But, you know, if you do have any other anecdotes or other things you might have seen, even if you want to talk more about the evolution of the relationship over time.
As I said, the benefits were on the whole were mutual in that I think it strengthened the ties between the navies.
Mm-hmm.
The beneficiary really was more the UK, I believe, than the US. They ultimately had a fleet of 4 submarines. We had a fleet of 41 submarines. The effect on U.S. Operations and the like of that program, the player sales agreement program, were not very significant to the U.S. They were quite significant to the U.K., of course, because it gave them their what they desired as an independent nuclear deterrent. Their submarine weapon systems, when they were deployed, were committed to NATO. However, they retained the right to act in national interest of the UK should such an emergency develop that it was necessary to do that. But we in our office had very warm relations with our British counterparts, we both socially as well as professionally, and I have dear friends even today. Those who survived as long as I have, which is non-trivial, ancient mariners like myself, who are that even today I still maintain very close relations with. And
oh, that's great. Hi, I want to ask a few more questions. Actually, questions about the, we'll say, the transition in cooperation from the Polaris system to other systems that came involved in other, specifically the Trident system. Your involvement with this, possibly we could talk a little bit about this, and also as a final, more longer-term question, if you think the British renewal of the Trident system has had any strategic importance for the United States, and if so, how?
As the United States moved along with our program, our Polaris program, we transitioned from Polaris to Poseidon, which was a larger missile carrying multiple warheads. The British had a dilemma as to whether or not they were going to follow the same path and continue to deploy a system which would become unique to them, the Polaris A3, or follow the U.S. and transition to Poseidon. There was a lot of internal debate within the United Kingdom about what they should do. Unlike the U.S., which had all of its scientific and technical as well as military capabilities being carried out by a single office, run by the United States Navy. In the U.K., the Royal Navy was focused almost exclusively on the military applications, but the research and development was under what they call their center scientists, the civilian leadership in the weapons establishment. And when we transitioned to Poseidon, it was largely under the impetus of concern for the continued ability to assure penetration capabilities of the weapon system in the face of very substantial nuclear defenses, ballistic missile defenses that were being deployed by the Soviet Union. Our approach to it was to exhaust missiles by deploying multiple warheads from each submarine launch missile that would assure penetration of these defenses by just simply overwhelming them with numbers. I'm making certain that each individual warhead was deployed in such a way that it would require a successful interceptor to take it out, but would only lose one warhead in the process. The UK, with its center scientists, were more interested in the R&D challenge of developing penetration aids, which with decoys and other devices simulated multiple warheads, but in fact were not decoys or other approaches to penetration. And for that, they were going to equip their Polaris missiles with this system, which was called Chevaline, C-H-E-V-L-I-N-E. So the Chevaline system was adopted by the British. The Royal Navy, I think, was officers that we dealt with were not happy about this at all. They did not like to see the U.S. and the Soviet and the U.K. going down separate paths, because the success of the program had been largely based on having identical systems in both programs. As I said, there was tension in the U.K. Ultimately, it was resolved that the U.K. would follow the U.S. and would adopt the Trident system. They'd skip. This was skipping over Poseidon. The Trident came along during my regime as the director of the U.S. program, and they decided to follow the U.S. in developing employing Trident in their submarines. I've sort of lost my track on your question. The question had to do with tensions.
Right. If there were, the other question was also a longer term one. If you wanted to address that about the British renewal of the Trident system and having a strategic importance for the United States.
Oh yes, the British actually when Trident became Trident One, which fitted into existing ballistic missile submarines. When Trident II came along, the so-called D-5 missile was much larger and required a new submarine to carry it. And in the U.S. case, the Trident submarines were supported out of Kings Bay, Georgia, and on the west coast, at Bangor, Washington. The UK chose to follow the US in that the same system, but they have been supporting their submarines out of Coolport, which is in Scotland. The Coolport facilities were not going to be capable of supporting that larger missile because it had more. With more safety distance required, and the explosive power of an accident would have exceeded the limits of the facility, and rebuilding the facility in order to take the larger missile would have been very, very, very expensive. So the decision was made that for Trident, unlike Polaris, for Trident the UK would depend upon the U.S. Base for at Kings Bay to handle their missiles and provide and assemble their missiles for them and stuff, which they had been doing on their own up until that time. So they, in effect, their program became even more dependent on the U.S. And yet they still had their own independent nuclear weapon. And we're purchasing U.S. missiles, just as they had been in Polaris, but the carrying out the details, they became more dependent on the U.S. facilities than before. Now, how did that affect us? Well, for one thing, the 41 Polaris submarines has become 14 Trident submarines. Just invert the numbers, and you've got the size. The British force of four submarines now is a larger contribution to the you might say the free world deterrent system than before. The weapon systems in the British arsenal are now more significant. Relative to our own. We in that sense are getting more out of the agreement than in the British contribution than we had otherwise. Did that answer?
Can you think of any events during your tenure that sped up or decelerated cooperation in this special partnership?
Yes, in the only one I can think of specifically was the acceleration of the program, which followed the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. That resulted in a substantial acceleration of the program, and of course the British shared in that acceleration. So I would say that that made the relationship even stronger, and that the importance of the nuclear deterrent in the course of in the wake of the resolution of that crisis emphasized how the effectiveness of nuclear deterrence in avoiding what might have otherwise become a general war. And the British and the U.S. both shared in that in the consequences of that recognition.
Did you encounter any trends on the British side that would have pushed more for an independent nuclear policy as a result of posture as a result of the Cuban Missile Crisis, in the sense of the United States would be making a decision for, in a sense, the free world, for, and they might suffer consequences?
Well, the British always have maintained an independent nuclear deterrent, in the sense that they don't depend on the U.S. for controlling their system. It's mm-hmm. entirely up to them to decide whether how it's to be employed,
right,
and when. So the independence of the British nuclear system, their capability, I think, has been maintained all along. And my reference to the Cuban Missile Crisis is merely an example of their sharing with us even more closely the maintenance of independent national nuclear deterrence and cooperation through the NATO agreement.
Does the recent decision of Great Britain to allow... How did the U.S. strategic mission for the Navy change with the end of the Cold War, and how did these changes affect this special partnership?
Well, the primary change since the end of the Cold War has been in the reduction of nuclear arsenals, both by the U.S. and the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, now Russia. The U.S. has phased out several of their nuclear weapons delivery systems and have reduced the numbers of others. I think I mentioned that the number of ballistic missile submarines has been reduced from 41 to 14 on the U.S. side. The net consequence of all of that is that over 50% of all of the U.S. Strategically deployed, operationally deployed nuclear weapons are now on submarines, whereas that during the Cold War you could not have made that statement. So the end of the Cold War has brought with it a reorientation of our nuclear forces, and which increase, if anything, the dependence on the Navy submarine ballistic missile systems. In the case of the UK, the dependence on their Navy system was total. There is no other nuclear delivery system that they had, having phased out their air delivered system so long ago. I would say the Navy's responsibilities for maintaining the U.S. strategic capability nuclear delivery deterrent is greater now by far. The big issue for both the U.S. and the U.K. now is with the end of the Cold War, the development of new systems has been pretty much slowed down or deferred indefinitely. Whereas one system used to follow another every few years, we haven't seen anything new being developed in several decades, couple of decades. we're facing into a situation where the weapon systems are aging, and we're going to have to make decisions on modernization, on whether or not that's to be done, and if so, how. The British share that need. At the moment, their plans are, as I understand them, are to build a new fleet of ballistic missile submarines, of 3 or 4, carrying the Trident II weapon system, or any missile that would be of that size, to replace their existing submarines, which are facing end of their service lives. The U.S. has exactly the same problem and the same challenge, and with that comes a host of issues about developing new systems, whether or not new missiles should be developed or could be developed or needed to be developed, or new warheads for the existing missiles or what. So these are issues that are post-Cold War issues that are current today, and the U.S.'s approach and the administration's proposal is to replace existing warheads with what they call reliable replacement warheads, which would be have the same capabilities, but would be designed to have more margin, have longer lifetimes, and in the process would maintain the industrial capabilities of the nuclear production complex, which also needs to be modernized, and the people who are retiring with expertise need to be replaced with a new generation of nuclear weapon scientists and designers. The British are facing the same issues, and there are hot internal debates in both countries on what is the way ahead. That's all I can really say, except that I watch this all with great interest and occasionally contribute to advice when sought.
What are some ways in which you think the United States, also Britain too, might be able to recruit, in a sense, or interest more people to go into these, especially nuclear scientists, to go into research and development?
With the cessation of nuclear testing, we have not conducted nuclear tests at all. We are depending almost exclusively on modeling and simulation, computer simulation, and non-nuclear experiments. It's difficult to maintain an atmosphere that would attract and challenge a new generation of scientists, if all of their designs were going to be were not going to be demonstrated, were going to be simulated and modeled and so on. There's plenty of challenge there, but it's not the same as if you were actually going to ask Mother Nature to give you the answer. My calculations really pan out in practice, and so it's going to be more challenging, and it is more challenging to bring good new talent on board to replace the folks that are retiring that had that experience in nuclear matters. But nevertheless, in spite of that, there is good new talent coming on board. That the laboratories do have excellent people, and for that, I'm both grateful and sometimes somewhat surprised.
Mm-hmm. I want to actually return to a subject we talked about briefly earlier, and pose it kind of as a get your reaction on some of this. Some people argue that the British nuclear deterrent is affected negatively by its reliance on the United States. What effect do you think the question of independence has had during your career on both the perception and practical decision making for both countries?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think that the dependence of the UK on the US has not really changed. It maybe changed in degree when we went to the larger Trident submarine ballistic missile. But the actual employment of these systems is completely independent on the part of the UK. US perhaps is getting a little more out of it now than they did before because the industrial base, for example, that supports the Trident weapon system gets a little more business, a little more work because of the UK requirements that they're meeting. It is a little bit easier with the help of the UK's the UK customer to maintain an active production capacity for the weapon system over and above what is needed by the U.S. And so I think the U.S. gets a benefit out of that. The workload at Kings Bay is greater because of the submarine, because of the ballistic missile submarine. The test database for the weapon system, less the warhead, is greater because of the testing that is conducted from British Trident submarines. All of whom are supported out of Kings Bay and at our test facility in off Cape Canaveral, Florida, where the demonstration shakedown operations are conducted by and also some of the operational testing. These are all identical missiles. These missiles come from a common stockpile. The British tests are all relevant to the U.S. stockpile, just as the U.S. tests are relevant to the British. The British could not, I don't believe, afford to build an independent database of their own missiles in order that would give you statistical confidence, rough, even remotely comparable to what they have, because they're sharing the U.S. database with identical missiles out of the identical population. So both countries get the benefits of the other's test data of a common population, and that's has always been true, but it's even more significant today with the smaller numbers of weapons. The Trident II missile system has conducted over 120 successful underwater launch tests of that missile from launch to impact, obviously less the nuclear warhead. Some of them conducted from British submarines, some of them conducted from U.S. submarines, but 120 successes without a single failure. There's no comparable record, to the best of my knowledge, of any strategic system that, whether it's a ballistic missile or a cruise missile or whatever, that begins to approach that record. Mm-hmm. And it is relevant to both systems, both of the navies.
Do you think, going back a bit, do you think the cessation of testing, or what type of impact did it have on the special relationship, if any, the cessation of testing the United States had?
It's indirect. The input, the the cessation of nuclear testing has impacted both the U.S. and the U.K. Warhead designs and confidence in them quite comparably. But the U.K. has its own laboratories at Aldermaston. The U.S. has its laboratories at Livermore and Los Alamos. Those laboratories cooperate, and they there are some test facilities that existed on one side of the ocean that don't exist on the other. There are some computer capabilities, simulation modeling capabilities that are developed on one side and rather than the other. But the laboratories cooperate, and I think that that fact is even more greatly emphasized now than before. Even though the warheads are independently designed, they do share these tools and exchanges with their scientists. So again, I think the cooperation has been increased since the Cold War rather than decreased.
Do you what is your advice for new generation of U.S. policymakers, and especially with regards to nuclear cooperation and the special partnership?
Well, there is a very strong set of voices in the U.K. as well as in the U.S. as well, who argue for a nuclear abolition. They're saying that the time for nuclear weapons has come and gone, that the world is a more dangerous place because of the existence of nuclear weapons, and we should be working more vigorously toward their total abolition. I'm very skeptical about, not that that isn't necessarily desirable or not desirable, but the feasibility of doing it, I think, is very questionable. We're living in a world where there are rogue nations and non-nation entities, non-national entities who are seeking or have acquired nuclear weapons or are seeking to acquire nuclear weapons. The nightmare scenario is for one of these rogues or one of these, in particular, non-nation state entities like Al-Qaeda to lay hands on a nuclear weapon because the inhibitions against the use of nuclear weapons, I think, would not be there. At least certainly it would be greatly diminished. And we might actually see a nuclear weapon being employed in a way that would destroy a large part of a Western city, U.S. or one of our allies. So it's a dangerous world, and for the U.S. to abandon, take the leadership in abandoning nuclear weapons, I would not affect those incentives whatsoever. They would be just as strongly after them as before. We have other countries that have nuclear weapons that are modernizing them and are increasing the size of their inventories. In a world like that, such as the practical one we live in, I think we should and can and are working very hard to reduce the nuclear danger by reducing the numbers of these weapons, by more securely locking them up and making certain that they can't be stolen, or not only the weapons but the special nuclear materials from which others can make weapons. A lot of things are going on, and we're cooperating with Russia. The U.S. and Russia together have a large fraction, a very large fraction of the total numbers of these nuclear weapons. Compared to them, the other nation, the national entities are very much smaller numbers. But both the U.S. and the Russians are reducing their size of their stockpiles. They're increasing their safety and security. They're cooperating together in that regard. I think that there are lots of things that can and are being done, but abolition, I don't believe, is a practical, realistic objective, at least in a, and so long as we have a world without an international rule of law that's enforceable. We can pass laws, we can write treaties, but as long as nation states are free to move off on their own without fear of any repercussions because of the there is no international rule of law. In the absence of that, I don't think abolition is a realistic objective.
And to wrap it up, how do you see cooperation with the British over the next, we'll say, 50 years?
Well, it depends. The British could are also considering abandoning nuclear weapons to set an example for others, perhaps. And we could diverge. It could result in the British abandoning nuclear weapons and the U.S. keeping theirs, or the reverse even. But somebody once said that predicting the future is difficult for. But in any case, the I really can't say how it will go. I can say what I recommend is that we not give up our nuclear capabilities in a world where the danger nuclear dangers exist and that we can't control proliferation. We're trying our best to do it. We reach international agreements to that end. We do share a desire for a non-nuclear world, which may or may not ever be achievable. As you may recall, not necessarily you're not old enough to recall it, but let me say that from one who is, that right up to the end of World War II, when we were the only nuclear power in the world, we took to the then new, brand new United Nations an offer we called the Bruch Plan. Bernard Bruch was our U.S. representative to the United Nations. And this plan was to give up nuclear weapons. The U.S. would give up its nuclear weapons and turn them over to an international authority. That was promptly vetoed by the that proposal was promptly vetoed by the Soviet Union, who was well on the way to acquiring their own capability. We didn't realize how close they were, but they weren't going to settle for a world where one power had a nuclear capability, even though it might have given it up to an international entity. The Russians moved ahead with their nuclear program, and so that the moment came and went when we might possibly have actually maintained a ban on nuclear, a national entity owning nuclear weapons. Since then, the nuclear proliferation, you might say, has gone on slowly. But steadily. There are five acknowledged nuclear states under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. France, Great Britain, Russia, the U.S., and China. There are additional states that have acquired nuclear weapons that were not signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, specifically India and Pakistan. North Korea, who was a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but chosen to abandon it. Iran, your guess is as good as mine as where they stand. Other nations have had nuclear programs and have walked away from them. Others are trying to acquire them, as far as we can tell. But nuclear proliferation, as long as we're in a dangerous world such as we are, you asked for my view. My view is we're going to need a nuclear capability that's safe, secure, and reliable, and dependable for as long as the world has a nuclear danger.
Thank you very much for your time, Admiral Wartime, and with that we will conclude this interview.